Welcome to Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer Writer Pants on Fire blog at writerwriterpantsonfire.blogspot.com. Welcome back to the show after the August break, especially to our new followers. Lots of great guests lined up for you this month, including The Serpent King author Jeff Zentner, Tiffany Jackson, author of Allegedly, and all-around famous person Gwenda Bond. There will also be a roundup episode at the end of the month, which will cover a current hot topic in publishing. If you'd like to support the show, please consider donating. Visit patron.podbean.com/writerwriterpantsonfire to give as little as $1 a month. Or if you'd prefer a one-time donation, check the provided links for this episode online at writerwriterpantsonfire.podbean.com or donate through PayPal to mindy@mindymcginnis.com. That's MindyMcGinnis. And let me know it's in support of the podcast. Today's guest is Madeline Rue, New York Times best-selling author of the Asylum series, Allison Hewitt is Trapped, Sadie Walker is Stranded, and the House of Furies series. Maddie joined me today to talk about the pros and cons of completing a literature program, including the neglect of genre fiction in the educational setting. She also shares her unique method of garnering an agent through an experimental fiction blog, which went on to become her debut novel. First off, tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to writing. Did you have any formal training or degrees? And also, we definitely want to hear about how you went about getting an agent.
I have a pretty unique backstory in terms of how I got my foot in the door in publishing. I studied creative writing in college. I went to Beloit College. I also studied theater. I had a double major. I didn't know if I was going to really do novels or what. It was always something I wanted to do, but I felt really intimidated by the process. And when you're an undergrad, they really stress doing short stories first, and they don't really teach you about genre fiction, which is what I always was kind of meant to be doing. They want to teach you to be very literary, and it was a good way to teach, but it wasn't really what I wanted to do. I was doing poetry, I was doing playwriting, short stories, and poking at trying to do novels. And then it really wasn't until my final year of college when I thought, you know, screw this, I really want to get into genre writing. I started with historical fiction. That was sort of my first love. I was doing that as the special project. They do these special terms at Beloit College. They're called honors terms. You've graduated, but you pitch something to like a panel of professors and you say, here's a project I want to do for a semester. This is how it benefits the community and this is how it benefits the college. I said, I will outline, write, and research a historical fiction novel in one semester. And I did it. So that was my first real attempt at writing a novel. It was cool because I got to take classes that were relevant to it. It was set in a medieval time period, so I was taking like Chaucer classes and stuff like that. While I was doing that, I was researching so heavily for that, I was sort of going crazy. And so I decided to, for fun, to blow off steam, write another book, because that's what you do when you're a crazy person. So I started writing this online serial fiction blog called Allison Hewitt is Trapped, set in the zombie apocalypse, and it was like real time. Every blog entry was a chapter in the book. And I stayed in character, and I had a fake email account set up for her and everything. People started commenting on it when they found it, and then I would sort of pull them into the narrative. They were all just either friends at first, but then also, you know, it sort of gained popularity after it got posted a few places, like Reddit and stuff like that. So then I had more people. The way I found an agent was through that, actually. My agent, Kate McKean, her brother, found the link on Reddit, read the blog, and said, hey, Kate, like, I think this is something you want to check out. It turned out that she was actually with an agency that I had queried with something else. I had queried her coworker, and then Kate found me on her own, totally organically. Oh, and we turned that zombie blog into an actual novel that came out. The half of it's still up on the internet. Like, I never took down the original blog. So as an artifact, it's still out there.
That is the most original story that I've had yet on the podcast about
Thank
how
you.
Authors found their agents.
it's fun to tell, but it's also, it makes me nervous because I think it's very unlikely that this would happen that often. I don't like telling it and then people think like, oh, I'm going to run off and do a serial fiction blog. I think there's a lot more noise on the internet these days. I honestly would recommend people to query the traditional way. I actually think you'll have a much better chance of being found and getting your stuff read.
So many new authors that I see, they're so frustrated with the query process, and I totally get that. I absolutely understand. But at the same time, I'm like, dude, I know you hate it, and I know it's painful, but it actually works.
Yes. Yes, it does. It totally does. And the thing is, I understand the query process. I was in the middle of it when this all happened. So when I'm in panels or, you know, mentoring someone, I still really heavily suggest that they go through the whole query process.
One of the reasons I didn't pursue any kind of classes in writing was because I really did feel that a lot of the focus was on literary work and poetry, like you were saying. Yep. You're not going to make a living doing that. It's like, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a writer. I knew I wasn't a poet, and all my ideas were genre fiction. So I was like, well, what's the point of this?
No, I totally agree. And honestly, I've been publicly and personally critical of this with my college because I honestly still don't understand. You're asking kids who are, you know, 18, 19, 20, you can't write some really introspective, nuanced, character-driven piece when you're that young. You just don't have the skill set. You don't have the style. It actually makes perfect sense to teach people the opposite, to be like, here's genre fiction. It has very basic rules. There are patterns. There are formulas to follow. Because I studied script writing on my own, I actually think that's why I sort of slid into writing genre books really naturally, because scripts are so formulaic. They have so many like beats, there's an act structure, and so do genre books. And I think that's much easier to do when you're younger, because it's like, here are some parameters, now learn how to internalize those parameters and make it your own. I still don't get it. I mean, I've like had many arguments with my old professors. I know you guys want to teach some kind of greater appreciation for these books. You're not really handing them the tools to make a career out of this. You absolutely can write a novel when you're 19 years old. Can you write Catcher in the Rye? Probably not, but you could write a pretty decent mystery novel. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. I mean, I don't regret it. I don't at all, but I did find it very, very frustrating.
A lot of the English literature classes that I took, because that's what my major was in. It was in literature. It wasn't in writing. And I learned so much that helped me become a better writer without doing any writing.
The degree that I got, it might as well have been a literary degree, because the volume of classes we had to take that were lit studies, essentially, I would say that was actually 90% of what we did. And then 10% of it was actual classes with workshopping and things like that.
People ask me, and I'm sure it happens to you too, what do I have to do to become a writer? And, you know, my answer is read.
Read a lot, write a lot. Even practicing stuff that is never going to see the light of day. I mean, the first novel-length thing I wrote was a Knights of the Old Republic fan fiction. It was like, oh, Jesus, this is 200 pages long somehow. Like, it was this weird confidence boost where it was like, okay, this clearly is not publishable, but it gave me the sort of internal confidence to be like, maybe I have what it takes to build my own worlds.
I think, too, that a lot of people are intimidated by the length when it comes to novels.
When I'm, like, seriously working on a book, I try to tackle about a chapter or two chapters a day. That, to me, is, like, a doable amount of work. I don't like to leave off in the middle of something. I feel like you can lose the internal logic or flow of the chapter. If you do that consistently, if you write a chapter or two a day for, you know, a month or two, it's like, well, you have a book. If you scale it back in terms of what your immediate goal is, it doesn't feel nearly as intimidating.
Let's talk a little bit about Allison Hewitt is Trapped, because it does have such a cool origin story. So that came out in 2011, and there was a follow-up, Sadie Walker is Stranded. So how did Sadie Walker then come about?
Well, I sold the initial book, Allison Hewitt, as a two-book deal. In my mind, it was a standalone, which is why Sadie Walker is like, it's in the same universe, but they're very loosely connected. It's a totally different set of characters. When we sold that, they said, it doesn't have to be a sequel. We just want something else from you as well. I was like, great, that's exciting. I think I pitched them four things after Allison Hewitt was done. And basically after like the fourth pitch, they're like, yeah, we really just want a sequel. I just decided to, you know, go with something in the same world, but not a direct sequel. I couldn't think of a way to restart her story. She comes to a really fitting closure point, and so I just decided to take a different cluster of survivors further along into the apocalypse. Allison Hewitt is like at the very beginning of the outbreak, and then Sadie Walker is more like further into the timeline.
It's interesting that you say that about the two-book deal. I had a similar, I shouldn't say problem. Obviously, a two-book deal is not a problem. Yeah. I had a similar experience with Not a Drop to Drink because I wrote it as a standalone. Because at the time, everyone was saying, we're sick of sequels, we're sick of trilogies, we're sick of waiting a year for the next book. We want standalones. So I wrote a standalone. And then Harper came back and said, we want two books. And I was like, okay. So I just agreed really quickly because, yes, like you said, new author. You're like, oh, yes, of course I will take a two-book deal. Thank you. I ended up writing a book, which I love, In a Handful of Dust. I actually think it's a better book than Not a Drop to Drink. But I had to come up with a synopsis, you know, something for them to buy from me fairly quickly in like a day. Like you were saying, story was over. I had no intentions of taking this anywhere else. So I was like, well, what if they had to walk to California?
I think most people would be shocked that aren't in publishing to realize how often things like that happen, where you sort of, like, an idea seems really great at the time and you think of plenty to do with it. And then once you're like deep in the shit of writing it, you're like, oh God, like, what have I done?
Up next, how the culture of celebrity in South America differs from the U.S., the ever-present disdain of YA, how to get banned, and the marketing push behind novellas. You travel extensively to promote.
More than some and less than some. I went to South America to tour for about a week. But yeah, I mean, you're working really hard, especially when you're abroad, because, you know, they don't know when they're going to get you there again. You know, you're getting up at 7 in the morning and you're doing school visits all morning long, and then you have press for hours and hours and hours, and then you'll usually have a signing in the evening. So, you know, you're pulling 10-hour days and trying to work on a manuscript at the same time, and you're jet lagged. I mean, it's a lot.
You've got a pretty big following in South America, don't you?
Asylum just really connected with that audience. It was super unexpected. I feel like they're more intense than American fans. And I mean that in like a good way. They're very passionate, and they get very proprietary about you. They're very like huggy and kissy, and I think that's really fun. So I did a United States tour 5 days with Victoria Schwab and Joelle Charbonneau, and that was really cool too.
Just from following your social media myself and knowing some of your experiences in South America, writers are almost their rock stars down there.
It's a totally different culture in terms of celebrity. Like, they take their books very, very seriously. I did a talk. I had to like address a room of librarians and essentially make the case for YA in libraries, because there's a real sense, like there is here, I think, and everywhere, that teenagers should be reading Shakespeare and serious work, not the candy for your brain. I brought up your books to them. I'm like, listen, there are people doing some things in this genre that your brain would explode if you read this book. Like, totally change your perspective of like what young adult is, because it's just like adult fiction in terms of variety, every genre and every spectrum of quality. I mean, if you stock Stephen King in your library, then you should stock YA. Yeah, it was interesting to get peppered with questions. Why should we do this? I mean, honestly, I feel like that's a really snobby question. Who are you to say that some of this stuff isn't going to be considered literary classics 20 years from now? Things that we love and research and study now were pop trash nonsense in their day. Dickens was not considered classy high art. This was stuff for the masses. How do you know that 20 years from now, some of this stuff in YA isn't going to be considered really valuable? That attitude is everywhere, but the young adult readers there just ignored that and have made authors down there into like real celebrities. Like, I got recognized at the airport. It was amazing. But that's not how it is in the U.S. Like, they think it's like that here too. And I had to explain many times that no. When we come to you guys, it's a very different experience. You take this up a notch in terms of intensity and passion for the genre.
YA is definitely looked upon as like the redheaded stepchild of writing. People have said you should write adult. I think that's such a weird thing to say, because the truth is I wouldn't change anything. I would write exactly the same if I was writing adult.
The complexity of the story and the content in terms of like sexuality and violence and stuff like that, you have to be mindful of. I think if more people knew the depth and breadth of what's available, they would be a lot less snobby about it, to realize like, yeah, we have literary writers in YA as well. In fact, I actually think YA is much more forgiving in terms of letting you blend genres. They'll let you do whatever you want to do. They're much less strict about like, no, this has to be fantasy. This has to be sci-fi. I feel like they kind of let you break the rules that way a little bit, which I think is super cool. And I wish would happen in general more in publishing.
When it comes to content, and I know that I'm the edge of the envelope when it comes to content, but I don't really worry too much about it. I mean, I just write the book, and every now and then they'll say, maybe you should take this out. And sometimes I say yes, and sometimes I say no. I have yet to be banned. I keep thinking this one's going to be the one. I have yet to
me
be banned.
Too.
I keep trying.
Oh, me too. Me too. I'm trying so hard. I'm like, come on, you got to hate this.
I thought for sure that Madness would get some eyebrows raised.
It didn't.
I thought Species would get banned. Nope.
I thought for sure Madness was headed for it. Like, Walmart carries Asylum, and I was like, have you guys read these? there's gay characters and trans characters and all kinds of stuff that I don't think they would approve of. But, I mean, all right, guys. Like, cool. No worries.
I am pretty sure what you have to do to get banned. I think you have to write female masturbation.
Really? Huh.
Do you remember, you probably would have been in high school. I might have just been out. There was a series, Alice on the Edge, Alice Alone, Alice Naturally There by Phyllis Reynolds.
I've heard of them. Her name sounds more familiar than the books, but I'm pretty sure I heard of them, yeah.
They start with the character fairly young, and then she's getting older, and then, like, in the eighth or ninth one, there's a masturbation scene, and unless you actually understand what's going on, you're not going to figure out what's going on. Oh, it got banned left and right. People went crazy. And there's been other books that I'm aware of that were banned. And male masturbation, too, but it's not quite the red flag.
Sex is fine, but not masturbation? Is that okay?
But not abstinence. Abstinence is not fine. Yeah, so that's the next thing. I'm going to make sure that I write some masturbation in my next book.
We should make this a trend. We should be like, we should just call up all the YA authors. We know, like, guys, we've got a plan. Yeah, a little bit of the self-love, and we're all going to get banned, and then our books will be
explode. We should just do an anthology.
Yes!
Let's just do an anthology.
Actually,
short stories.
That's not a bad idea. We might have to, like, discuss that further. That actually is kind of a brilliant idea. I'm sure HarperCollins will be thrilled.
Oh, yes. I know my editor listens to this podcast sometimes, so he might be riding on the subway right now, just shaking his head. It's like, oh my god. Can't wait for that to cross my desk. Let's talk about the Asylum series, because that is what you're most well-known for. There are four in the series, correct?
There's three and then a prequel, and then there's three novellas. Okay. Yeah, and then the novellas, I mean, you can buy them individually, digitally, or in the anthology that's actual, like, a physical copy, so.
Tell us a little bit about how novellas work, writing the novellas, as far as word count, etc., kind of what the idea in the publishing industry is about novellas.
The publisher was like, hey, what if we did these little novellas, and I was kind of not sure about it, and then they really emphasized the fact that I could do whatever characters that seemed right for each one. And so they're sort of bridges between the books. So the first one, I guess technically the first one because of the prequel, is the Warden. And so that, like, sets up one of the main characters that's in the prequel. And it was really fun to find, because all the other ones are from male perspective. So to finally get to write a female perspective in the Asylum series was really nice. It's a period piece because it's set in the 60s, and so I got to do a lot of that fun stuff and write from, like, a nurse in the 60s working at an actual, like, functioning asylum, which is the asylum that becomes sort of the haunted establishment in the other books. From a marketing perspective, I feel like it's a sort of, hey, don't forget that this series is still going. they come out kind of in between books. So it's this reminder that, you know, oh, hey, there's a little more for you here. You know, it's like it kind of tides you over until the next book comes out. I mean, my books come out once a year, so it's not like you're waiting that long. But, okay, now you only have to wait like 6 months. Here's a novella, that kind of thing. For me, it was a cool way to explore some of the other characters in this expanding world of the Asylum series, give you a, you know, a look from someone else's perspective, especially because the Scarlets, which is the one between Asylum and Sanctum, you're seeing things from a perspective of a character that's essentially a villain in Sanctum. It's kind of a cool twist to be able to have a little mini book where you're learning about this person who becomes one of the antagonists in Sanctum. It kind of gives you these different perspectives and a different flavor of the books and fills in some details about the world that you really can't get that information from Dan's perspective in the books because he just doesn't know about it or it happened before he's on the scene. I really approach those actually more in a literary way where it's like, this is almost more of a character study because I want you to get to know this character that's going to be more of a periphery player in this upcoming book. I really want to get you inside of their head and provide like an alternative view of things, color in things that you won't get as much information on in the books. And in terms of length, I usually shoot for about 60 pages, give or take. I don't know what word count that is, but that's about where I try to be. I structure them really similarly to a book. There's just fewer subplots. They're just simpler. You know, you have less time to do things. So you kind of have to pick one main story you're telling and maybe one very small, uncomplicated subplot. It was funny because when they asked me to do them, I was like, cool, I've never written a novella before, so hopefully I can do this.
The way that I always felt about it from a librarian's point of view and from a reader's point of view was just like you said, that it's there as a reminder. You know, there's another book coming out in this series and a little something to keep you invested because yes. Typically... And you might have a different experience with this because your book, your series kind of grew organically, but typically sequels have a 40% sales drop off from the first book.
Yes.
Increasing then the third book and the fourth book, the sales continue to fall off. You lose readers. And I think that the novella is a marketing ploy to keep people invested, keep people interested. But I do think it's really an interesting opportunity for the authors to dive back in and play with their world a little bit. I know for the paperbacks of Not a Drop to Drink and A Handful of Dust, I wrote short stories set in the world that they then released as, you know, extra content in the paperbacks. Oh, nice. And yeah, I loved doing it. It was so much fun.
I feel like some of the novellas are some of the best stuff actually in the Asylum series, just because you feel less pressure and there's less stakes. You're kind of like taking this one little corner of the world and developing it. And so I just feel like you get to have a little more fun. It's like bonus content. So you're sort of just getting a little bit of room to do whatever you want. I wasn't really convinced at first, but then getting to do them was actually really pretty delightful because it was really low pressure.
You're right. The stakes aren't as high. If your novella bombs, it doesn't really matter. Right.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions on Tumblr and Facebook and stuff like, do I have to read them? It's like, no, they're bonus. Like, they're not integral to understanding what's going on in the actual books, but I think you'll find them very interesting, and I think they'll embellish the world and the story. I think they do add to the experience in a significant way. The number one question I get is, what the order of your books? And I'm like, I just tattoo it on my forehead at this point. It's like, It's at least twice a day I get a DM about it. No matter how many times I repost the order on my Facebook page, it doesn't matter.
One of the Ohio authors that I hang out with over here is Cinda Williams Chima, and she has three different fantasy series. Ooh. Two of them have somewhat similar covers and similar titles in all, across both series. On her website, just created a page where it's like, these are my three different series, these are the titles in each series, and this is the order you read them in. And when she gets that question, because like you, she gets it two or three times a day, she just shoots them a link.
I have it on my Tumblr. When you Google what is the order of the Asylum books, it should be the top link that comes out. And I repost it every few weeks. And every time I get a message, I just send them there. And it's also especially confusing because one of them's a prequel and you could technically read it first. It's fine. You can do that. Really, you're supposed to read it at the end. There's even a convoluted answer to the question, which really does not help at all.
Continuing the conversation with the pressure of following up a New York Times best-selling series, the pain of having a project close to your heart not find its audience, and what to look for next from Maddie.
You're prolific. I mean, I think you're like me. I think you write fairly quickly. You just had another book come out in May, House of Furies. So that's the beginning of another series, correct?
Yeah, it's the first in a trilogy. I just turned in the second one. I can't tell you the title yet, but it should be... We should be releasing the cover and the title soonish.
Yeah. I think the title's on Goodreads, actually.
Oh, is it? God. See, they tell me to keep all this stuff a secret, and then it leaks inevitably.
I know.
But yeah, no, it's the first in a trilogy. As far as I know, unless they ask for, like, novellas, it's hard because it's, like, it's selling well, but it's obviously, it didn't debut on the bestsellers list or anything. I think it's also one of those series where the first book is kind of a slow burn, but then the second one is pretty much action from page one because there's so much setup that I had to do in the first book. Bring you into this world and get you invested in the characters and get you to be on this journey with Louisa. But once that's established, book two, it's just there's much more actual plot, story. And I think it's tough because I do think in young adult, there's this real push for nonstop plot, action, things like that. And it's a gothic fantasy. You know, it's more like Jane Eyre than it is anything else. And to me, those books don't, you know, they're not like a rollicking theme park ride. They're sort of this like creeping, slow experience. I think it would be disingenuous to write a gothic fantasy that's just like explosions and car chases, carriage chases and shit. Like it's, you know, I think part of the experience is that you're being sort of hooked into it. Of the bad reviews I've seen, the number one complaint is like, it's too slow. And I'm like, well, it's not Mission Impossible. It's like Jane Austen with monsters. So give it a minute. You know what I mean?
Jane Austen with monsters is like the best pitch for that book ever. I love it.
Well, I mean, that was like what I wanted to do because I was a Jane Austen fanatic. I mean, I still am. But as a kid, my mom had me reading those books when I was in like sixth grade. I mean, it was ridiculous. So I love the idea of this really proper, established world with a lot of rules and a lot of social mores. But then there's this real ugly darkness underneath it, which there was in terms of social structure. It works on two levels in House Furies, hopefully. It's what I love doing. I love historical things and I love fantasy elements and a little bit of creepiness. So I just wanted to sort of blend all those things together and give a protagonist that's in the feeling of a Jane Austen book, but a little more sassy and world weary, because I feel like so many of the characters in Jane Austen books, they sort of have this really naive understanding of the world. And so to have a girl who's more on her own and a runaway and has had to take care of herself and had to steal to get by and things like that, the people who seem to like it, like, really, really love it, which is what I was hoping. And I think it has a very specific audience that it needs to find. It's not as broad, I don't think, as Asylum.
The way that you phrased that when you said, well, it's selling well, but it didn't hit the NYT or anything. And it's so true that if you're going to hit, you're going to hit the week of release and your sales are going to go down after that. Unless, barring some kind of, like, a celebrity says something about your book or it's, I don't know, in an old episode of Friends somehow. So it's like, that's the kind of thing that will make you take off other than your release week. That's why release week is so stressful, because if you don't hit then, you're not going to.
It was tough to be in the middle of working on the second book while being consumed with anxiety about how the first book was going to do. And I think it really blew me off course. People put so much pressure on your release week, and to an absurd degree. I mean, it's stupid. Guys, only 10 books are going to hit that list, so, like, it's not going to be everybody. Writing Asylum, having that hit the list, and be finishing Sanctum, it's like it gives you this morale boost where you feel, like, invincible. My book's on the New York Times bestsellers list. This is incredible. And you just feel, like, really energized to work. House Furies comes out. It's selling well, but it's not exploding across the YA sphere, that, like, puts you in a dark place because you feel like you've let people down. Like, you feel like you've not only let yourself down because you really want people to read it, but you've let, like, your publisher down and, you know, all these people who put all this time and money and effort into promoting it and working on it. So, you know, I was in a pretty rough place when it first came out because you're just, like, bookmarks made and tea made and candles made and necklaces made. And it's like you put all this intense personal energy into it. This is my favorite book I've ever written. So the stakes personally are so high because you just want people to read it so badly. Because you're like, if I can just get this to somebody, they're going to love it as much as I do. Mm-hmm. You're so invested. And then when it doesn't absolutely like catapults to the top of the world, you feel like you've somehow done something wrong, that you've failed on some level. And so it's tough. It makes it hard to get up every morning and go to work. You're like, huh, well, is anybody going to read the second book? It puts you in a pretty dark place. But then, you know, you kind of have to just rally back from that and be like, you know what? There are some people who have already gotten in touch and said they absolutely love it. Like, I'm writing this sequel for those people. And I just have to, like, put as much of myself and as much of my energy and my work ethic into this second book and try to make it even better.
I have a similar situation with A Madness So Discreet. That is probably my favorite book that I've written.
It's a masterpiece.
And it is
it's
my least well said. Thank you. Oh, I appreciate that. Well, it's good
true.
To hear because technically it's a flop.
I know, but I tell people about that book at, like, every panel when they're like, oh, I want it. What else
Thank
should I be
you.
Reading if I'm reading Asylum? I'm like, you should pick up A Madness So Discreet. It's going to blow your brains out.
Yeah.
That does something that no other YA book has done. And I feel like House mm-hmm. of Furies exists in a really weird in-between place where it's like, well, it's not technically, like, horror. There's creepy parts to it. And it's also a period piece. And it's also a fantasy. So it's, like, it's really hard to market something like that because it's not just like it's like Twilight but in space, you know, like it's really hard to sort of there's it's hard to do the like elevator pitch for something that's like nuanced. I mean it's true. That sounds
yeah.
really snobby. I'm sure that I sound like a total jackass, but I think it's true. If it's something that's like really basic to understand, I think it's easier to sell. And even when I say like, yeah, it's like Jane Austen with monsters, it's close but it's not like quite there, you know. So
no, you're right. When you have a book like that, that is layered and nuanced and not easily crammed into a genre niche, it is hard to pitch. When I'm doing a panel and people say to me, well, what's A Madness So Discreet about? And I say,
you're like, well, how much time do you have?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, there is no elevator pitch for this book. It's about insanity and pregnancy and assault and abuse and serial killers and insane asylums, the beginning of criminology. And it's like, if I've lost you after that, then it's not for you.
Yeah. I was reading it when I blurbed it and I was like, God, I love this book. I don't think anybody's going to read it. Like,
yep.
I feel so
yep.
bad saying that, but I was just like, this beginning is so hard to get through. It's so brutal. It's so relentless.
Yep.
I love it, but I just have this feeling someone's going to pick it up and just be like, I don't have the emotional stamina for this. Some of the easier swallowable concepts, by virtue of being easy to describe, they're going to do better. It sucks. That's my favorite book of yours, and this is my favorite book of mine. I feel like
we blurb them for each other.
I know. And it's so bitter to say the best art just goes underappreciated. That's absurd. It's like I feel that way, but I don't feel that way, but I do. The things you really pour your heart and soul into are not always for the mass market, and that's a frustrating thing to realize. But
yeah.
Do I really want to write things that I'm not 100% in love with? No, not really, not anymore.
But it's a good lesson for people out there that want to be writers and you've got that weird little niche book that you love and you want to write, definitely write it. And there is someone out there that will champion it for you, but you're probably not going to
yes.
hit the NYT with it. Just know
yes.
that.
Or I feel like this is one of those books where like I could see it reaching its audience when all three books are out and you can kind of see the shape of it better. Once people
uh-huh.
see the second book and kind of see how much happens and see how much more the world opens up, Iris's illustrations are just breathtakingly beautiful. I'm
mm-hmm.
like, okay, if you don't buy it for my writing, buy it for her artwork because it is absolutely unbelievable how talented she is. And writing the second book was such a cool experience because I didn't know who was going to illustrate House of Furies when I wrote it. now that I know that it's her, I want to play to her strengths now as well. And I know what her style is. I know what she's best at. So now as I'm planning these monsters and I'm planning these encounters, I can not only do what I do, but put her in a position to succeed as well. I know what she loves to draw because I follow her obsessively on Instagram, and everybody should. Now, so now I'm like, okay, I can work for both of us now. Really cool partnership in a way. And if nothing else, I want this book to succeed so more people find her. She's so good.
I have yet to have an illustrated book. I have yet to have a map. I really would love to have a map. Like, that's a goal.
Dude,
I know a lot
fun.
Of authors have map goals. Are you able to talk about your new announcement?
Well, I have two things coming up. In October, From a Certain Point of View, the Star Wars anthology comes out, and I have a short story in that. And you should all pick it up. I get to write Leia's parents on Alderaan as it explodes. So it's pretty
nice.
Intense. Yeah, it's no pressure. It's only my entire life.
It's only like one of the most iconic scenes right. In film history.
I only have Princess Leia tattooed on my body. No big deal. I just sold a sci-fi horror romance to Penguin. That will be coming out sometime in 2019. I don't know exactly when yet. And that's adult sci-fi retelling of Beauty and the Beast. Frickin' stoked. I think it's going to be
that is
really fun.
Super exciting.
The working title right now is Salvaged. I don't know if that's what it's going to be.
Okay.
Right now we're doing sort of a similar thing to Allison Hewitt, but at least I know this time, where we're doing multiple books but set in the same universe. They'll all sort of be different fairy tales retold in a sci-fi horror setting. So right now it's two books, but also subject to change. I don't know.
I know you are really active on social media, so why don't you let everyone know where they can find you online so they can follow you?
Yay, please do. I really like to interact with people. I usually will message back or tweet back or whatever. I'm on Facebook. Just search Madeline Rue. The fan page should be the first thing that pops up. It has my headshot, black and white. And then Twitter, I am at Author Rue, all one word. So it's AUTHOROUX. And also searching my name, Madeline Rue, will bring it up. Instagram, I am LIL_WOKLING, Lil Walkling. Walklings are what you call a baby Ewok. I have an Ewok thing.
Yes.
Or search my name again. It'll come up. And then Tumblr, it's Author Rue, like the Twitter tag, authorrue.tumblr.com. And I do a lot of blogging about writing, and I'll answer questions and things like that. Please come find me.
Very
I'm
nice.
So lonely. Well, this has been fun.
All right.
You're so fun.
Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis. Music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow authors Alyssa Palombo and R.C. Lewis, as well as patron Stephen Avery for helping to make this episode possible. If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/writer writer pants on fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist.